Open your Bibles, if you will, to Nehemiah. Nobody knew that was coming. Nehemiah, chapter 7. We're going to do things a little bit differently this evening from the way we have done it. Because I find this to be one of those interesting chapters, and yes, I did say interesting, that is predominantly made up of names. About 60 verses of names. And we have a tendency as we come to such chapters within the Bible to mentally go, and if you have to read them out loud, as I will this evening, you even more go, But what I want to do this evening, to make sure that none of you drone off into sleep or your minds go into the workday tomorrow or anything like that, is I'm going to read through the chapter. And as we're reading through the chapter, I hope you'll be paying attention, because I'm then going to ask you what we have to learn from this chapter. And don't worry, it's not because I didn't prepare the lesson for this evening, but there are some very interesting things to learn from this chapter, and I want to make sure we're thinking as we're reading. Then it was, when the wall was built and I had hung the doors, when the gatekeepers, the singers, and the Levites had been appointed, that I gave charge of Jerusalem to my brother Hanani, and Hananiah, the leader of the citadel, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. And I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot. And while they stand guard, let them shut and bar the doors, and appoint guards from among the inhabitants of Jerusalem, one at his watch station and another in front of his own house. Now the city was large and spacious, but the people were in it. Were few, and the houses were not rebuilt. Then my God put it in my heart to gather the nobles, the rulers, and the people, that they might be registered by genealogy. And I found a register of the genealogy of those who had come up in the first return, and found written in it, these are the people of the province who came back from the captivity, of those who had been carried away, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away, and who returned to Jerusalem and Judah, every one to his city. Those who came with Zerubbabel were Jeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Rehemiah, Nehanai, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mishpareth, Bigvai, Nehelm, and Banan. The number of the men of the people of Israel, the sons of Parosh, 2,172. The sons of Shephatiah, 372. The sons of Arah, 652. The sons of Pahath-Moab, of the sons of Jeshua and Joab, 2,818. The sons of Elam, 1,254. The sons of Zattu, 845. The sons of Zikai, 760. The sons of Benui, 648. The sons of Bebai, 628. The sons of Azgad, 2,322. The sons of Adonikam, 667. The sons of Bigvai, 2,067. The sons of Adin, 655. The sons of Atur of Hezekiah, 98. The sons of Hashem, 328. The sons of Bizai, 324. The sons of Harith, 112. The sons of Gibeon, 95. The men of Bethlehem and Netophah, 188. The men of Anathoth, 128. The men of Beth Azmaveth, 42. The men of Kirjath-Jearim, Shepherah, and Beeroth, 743. The men of Ramah and Geba, 621. The men of Michmash, 122. The men of Beth-El and Ai, 123. The men of the other Nebo, 52. The sons of the other Elam, 1,154. The sons of Harim, 320. The sons of Jericho, 345. The sons of Lod, Hadid and Ono, 721. The sons of Sinea, 3,930. The priests, the sons of Jedaiah, of the house of Jeshua, 973. The sons of Immer, 1,052. The sons of Pashur, 1,247. The sons of Harim, 1,017. The Levites, the sons of Jeshua, of Kadmiel, and of the sons of Hodeva, 74. The singers, the sons of Asaph, 148. The gatekeepers, the sons of Shalom, the sons of Ater, the sons of Talmon, the sons of Akab, the sons of Hattitah, the sons of Shobai, 138. The Nethinim, the sons of Ziha, sons of Hesufa, the sons of Tebaoth, the sons of Kiros, the sons of Sia, the sons of Padan, the sons of Lebanon, the sons of Hagabah, the sons of Salmai, the sons of Hanan, the sons of Gidel, the sons of Gehar, the sons of Reaiah, the sons of Rezin, the sons of Nekoda, the sons of Gazim, the sons of Uza, the sons of Pasiah, the sons of Bizai, the sons of Meunim, the sons of Nephisim, the sons of Bakbuk, the sons of Hekufa, the sons of Harher, the sons of Bezlith, the sons of Mehida, the sons of Harsha, the sons of Barkus, the sons of Sisera, the sons of Tema, the sons of Neziah, the sons of Hatipha, the sons of Solomon's servants, the sons of Sotai, the sons of Sophereth, the sons of Perida, the sons of Jeelah, the sons of Darkan, the sons of Gidel, the sons of Shephatiah, the sons of Hatil, the sons of Pokereth, of Zebaim, and the sons of Ammon. All the Nethinim and the sons of Solomon's servants were 392. And these were the ones who came up from Telmilah, Telharsha, Cherub, and Adon, and Immer, but they could not identify their father's house nor their lineage, whether they were of Israel. The sons of Deliah, the sons of Tobiah, the sons of Nekoda, 642. And of the priests, the sons of Habai, the sons of Kaz, the sons of Barzillai, who took a wife of the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and was called by their name. These sought their listing among those who were registered by genealogy, but it was not found. Therefore, they were excluded from the priesthood as defiled. And the governor said to them that they should not eat of the most holy things till a priest could consult the Urim and the Thummim. Altogether, the whole assembly was 42,360. Besides their male and female servants, of whom there were 7,337, and they had 245 men and women singers. Their horses were 736, their mules 245, their camels 435, and donkeys 6,720. And some of the heads of the father's house gave to the work The governor gave to the treasury 1,000 gold drachmas, 50 basins, and 530 priestly garments. Some of the heads of the father's house gave to the treasury of the work 20,000 gold drachmas and 2,200 silver minas. And that which the rest of the people gave was 20,000 gold drachmas, 2,000 silver minas, and 67 priestly garments. So the priests and the Levites and the gatekeepers, the singers, some of the people, the Nethinim, and all Israel dwelt in their cities. When the seventh month came, the children of Israel were in their cities. All right. Easy enough. Everybody picked something up out of that, right? So let's begin at the beginning of the chapter. Somebody tell me something that's significant that we found at the beginning of the chapter.
King James.
It's the term that was translated children in the King James was generally used for sons, but bear in mind that when it was written in the Hebrew, it wasn't necessarily declaring that all of them were sons. It was simply a use of the term descendant, but predominantly, that was what was counted, was the males. And so therefore, the use of the Hebrew word for son, generic children. Does that answer anything? Okay.
Genealogy at this point in history was important to God.
Absolutely. All right. What was significant about a person's genealogy as an Israelite?
He had to be a Levite
and serve the priest. Okay. Levites, you had to be a Levite of the lineage of Aaron to serve as a priest. If you were of one of the other houses of the Levites, you served in other capacities around the tabernacle or temple. Was there any other tribe of which there was a peculiarity concerning their lineage? All right. During the wilderness wanderings, this would have been before they actually came into the land of Israel. During the wilderness wanderings, they were each given a particular spot around the tabernacle. The tabernacle was always the center of the camp, and each one was at a different point around the camp, and they all moved in a particular order. Whenever the camp moved, certain ones moved first, certain ones second one third, fourth, and so on. All right. Anything else concerning a particular tribe?
Had they already gotten their portion of the promised land?
All right. The inheritance of the promised land was divided up based upon family going all the way back to the days of Joshua. And in order to receive your inheritance, when they came back into the land of Israel, they didn't just go and settle wherever they wanted to. They had to go back to their portion, their inheritance within Israel. And they did. That's the emphasis there in the end of the chapter of, and the rest of the people, or verse 73, so the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, some of the people of Israel, and the Nethinim, and all Israel dwelt in their cities. All right? They returned to the land of their inheritance when they returned to Israel. They didn't all just go congregate in Jerusalem. So they had been in Jerusalem to build the wall, but they all had separate inheritances that were given by God, and they were not allowed. Matter of fact, every 50th year of Jubilee, even if for some reason, because of their poorness, they had to sell off the land, it automatically went back to their family. All right? So, an importance of lineage was it dictated where you lived. What else? Still looking for something specific about one tribe.
Which was the first mention of Christ coming through Judah?
That goes all the way back to Isaac making his prophecy, or excuse me, Jacob as Israel making his prophecies before he died, back in the book of Genesis, after they were down in Egypt. So, yes, that was the one I was looking for, was the Messiah was going to come out of Judah. All right? Now, understand, predominantly, these are all children of Judah, predominantly. You've got Levites and you have some of the other tribes mixed in here that had gone into captivity and then come back. But predominantly, were talking all concerning those of the tribe of Judah, because they were the ones left. The northern kingdom, the northern 10 tribes, had already been taken away by Assyria.
Well, I was going to say they wouldn't let some of the people in because they were not registered as one of them.
All right. All right. You have there among the listings, those in verse 61, going down through verse 65, that it is interesting. They are refused part in the priesthood because they could not prove their lineage. They could not even prove they were Israelites. It's interesting to note. And yet, lineage was so much a part of the Israelites' life that there was no way an Israelite was going to get to the point where they couldn't prove their lineage, because that was something they protected very dearly, which, by the way, is interesting to consider when all the records were destroyed in AD 70 by the Romans, because they were in the temple. But that's cited.
So at this point in time, Judah and Israel stand for the same people.
Yes.
There's no northern and southern anymore.
Correct.
All Israel.
Correct.
It's just Judah.
All right. Going back to the beginning of the chapter, what else do we see? What?
That's kind of verses 1, 2, and 3. Then very important.
Absolutely.
Faithful man, fear God.
All right. I was hoping somebody was going to pick that out. First three verses, he pointed out, are very interesting, very important. Notice what Nehemiah does. He says, then it was, the wall was built and I hung the doors. And remember back in the previous chapter, they had a wall built, but the doors weren't hung. And when the gatekeepers, the singers, and the Levites had been appointed, then I gave charge of Jerusalem to my brother Hanani, which, if you remember back to chapter 1, Hanani was the one who came to Babylon. And he was the one who found out word concerning Jerusalem's situation from him. All right, so he came back with Nehemiah when Nehemiah came. All right, and then Hananiah, the leader of the citadel, notice, going back to the Hebrew, it seems that this was specifically speaking concerning Hananiah and not Hanani. For he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Notice you have someone here who is appointed to a civil position because of his fear of God. Now, you may say, well, it doesn't say that he feared God above any of the others. Well, that may be true. He was given a civil position that he was qualified for. There may have been somebody who maybe feared God more than he did in Israel, but he wasn't qualified to hold the position of leader of the city of Jerusalem and to be the one in charge of Jerusalem. All right. So you have two men, first of all, chosen because of their leadership qualities. All right, you've got Hanani, who already, by implication, the fact that he had come to Jerusalem previously, had then returned to Babylon and is now back in Jerusalem, he carries some clout. You know, this wasn't just a journey you made willy-nilly going down to Raleigh and back. All right, and this is someone who, by all indications, was Nehemiah's physical brother and had some leadership qualities and also shared Nehemiah's devotion to God. That's why I believe there's no specific mention concerning his fear of God, whereas there is concerning Hananiah. Nehemiah, it seems already implicit, knew, and everyone else knew, that Hanani was of the same, shall we say, yoke as Nehemiah was. And then you've got someone who's not a member of Nehemiah's family, who is chosen because he was faithful. All right. What does that idea of faithful mean?
Trustworthy.
All right. If you're going to put a whole city, not only a city, but the capital city of your whole nation in the hands of somebody, better be trustworthy. Now, what's the major problem we have with the majority of people in Washington? They're not trustworthy. This was an essential trait of someone in a civil position. Which, by the way, if you go back and read a lot of the writings of founding fathers, that was one thing they emphasized over and over again, is put people in positions of power that are trustworthy. Matter of fact, Ben Franklin pointed out that if you want men of honor to hold positions of power, don't pay them. Because men who are dishonorable will not come to a position of power because if it doesn't have any pay involved in it. They want, they're in it for themselves, all right? They're not in it for the responsibility or the honor or to serve. They're in it for what they get out of it, all right? But point is, you have men here who are first of all trustworthy, second of all, and I think this one even comes more important than the other one, but the other is a byproduct of this one, they feared God. They were of the same mindset that Nehemiah was, that they were serving God in their civil capacity. Not they were serving themselves. Okay? When you have someone who's serving people, well, then their allegiance is to people. When you have someone who is serving themselves, their allegiance is to themselves. When they're serving God, their allegiance goes just a little bit higher and dictates the remainder of their actions. All right? Verse 3 is, I think, also interesting. What's interesting about verse 3? All right. You don't open the gates till the sun is high. All right. And a lot of commentators say this is sunrise. That's not what the verse says. The verse says till the sun is hot. All right. You don't get that until about mid-morning. You start really feeling the sun once it comes out and it starts burning and the day starts heating up. Okay. Especially in this area of a land. And so you would have been in a situation where you don't open the gates till you can see clearly who's outside. It was a matter of protection. It was a matter of making sure that the city was safe. And he charges Hanani and Hananiah with the protection of the city. He says, you set guards. They don't open the doors. They don't open the gates until the sun is hot. And I find it interesting. Before the sun goes down, the doors are shut again. And it is my understanding and my judgment based upon the reading of this is that there was only one watch. All right? Those same people who opened the city gates, before their watch was done in the day, they closed the city gates. All right? There was no change of guard, no letdown or opportunity for someone to come in. The same guards were there at the gates. They opened the doors, they shut the doors. All right? And where else did they place a watch? Okay. There were those who had watch over positions at different stations, but they also had watches and guards set at people's homes. It was the people who lived in those homes that set those watches. Now, the idea seems to be that those houses and homes that existed within the city were built along the wall. If you go back to the earlier chapter when we were reading, this person built this place, this person built this part of the wall. You remember all those times where they said, and they built adjacent to their house. All right? So they were to set watch. The citizens were taking part in the defense of the city. And he emphasizes why. Because the houses were few. You've got a city that is going back to the original size that it was when Jerusalem was the epitome of social prominence and power in Israel. And yet, that was when the nation and the kings dwelled there, and that's not there anymore. You know, you have a total number of people in the whole land numbering 42,000. How many? There were more than that in Jerusalem alone before they were taken captive. All right? Jerusalem was probably a city of upwards to 300,000 or 400,000 people when Babylonian captivity happened. And so you got a city that they have rebuilt the walls to the size it was before. Capacity of multiple hundreds of thousands of people, and yet there's only 42,000 Israelites in the whole land now. That's not just in the city of Jerusalem. So all throughout the city, the citizens had to take part in the watch to protect the city because there weren't enough people. Okay? Whose choice was it to number the people? God's. You may remember when David was king. He had been commanded by God to not number the people. Why?
He didn't need to know the number. That way he depended on God.
Absolutely. God's point was, don't number the people. Don't find out how many soldiers you have. Don't find out the number of the people that could fight. You don't need to know that. Just trust me. If I tell you to go out to war, then you'll succeed if you have one, or as Gideon, 300. Or if you have 12,000, doesn't matter. You just trust me, I'll take care of it. But he numbered the people anyway. What happened?
Paid the price.
Paid the price.
3 days of what?
3 days of pestilence. Or basically a plague for 3 days. Thousands died. It was one of three options God gave him. He chose the one he thought would be the least. Thousands died. But the difference here is God tells Nehemiah, number the people. What benefit came from it?
Kept the lineage pure.
Kept the lineage pure. There were those, by implication, who were serving in a capacity of priests who could not be qualified to be priests. And God knew it. But he used this method, and I believe there's other things that come from it as well. But you have the people who are, again, recognizing where they belong within the inheritance structure of the Israelites. But you also, in addition to that, have the importance of maintaining the purity of the worship of God. Only because they numbered the people. What else do we find in this chapter? I'm not really looking at any major significance from any of the names, just so you know. I wasn't thinking, ooh, will somebody pick up on this one?
Well, God sent them down to battle and captivity because of their disobedience, but he also brought them back to serve his purposes.
Absolutely. All right.
I find it interesting, usually what you read is very, God puts things very much in order. But he's got, in verse 5, he's got the statement, and I found over there. It's like, oh, hey, look what I found in the corner. You know, just the way that's worded is different to me. Mm-hmm. I like them.
Right. They found the word of God, was it in Josiah's
day? Yes, in Josiah's day.
They got out of the rubble in the temple. I wonder if that's where they found this, in the rubble in the temple.
All right. The indication seems to be, and it may have been something that was left in the, the house of the governor, or such, because of Zerubbabel in the past being governor over Israel in the first return, and so on and so forth. All right. Anything else you find interesting?
One reason they found it was because God wanted it.
Okay.
And it did it for them.
All right. I will point out one name. Does anybody know who the sons of Asaph were and what significance they hold in Old Testament Scripture? First of all, what were they? The book of Psalms is, while we often talk about it, a lot of them being written by David, many of them were written by Asaph, who was the father of these individuals, but also many of them were written not during David's time, not during Solomon's time, but after the return of the people from Babylonian captivity by the sons of Asaph. All right, or written for the sons of Asaph. Implication being, these were professional singers and people were writing songs to give them to sing. Okay? So you have a significance here of in a genealogy, an explanation of something that happens in Psalms and some of these Psalms that historically you wouldn't necessarily know where they fit in history without the mention concerning Asaph and his sons, his lineage, here in the book of Nehemiah. All right? Anything else toward the end of the book?
Well,
together to give the notice.
All right.
They're the ones who make history. And of course it says together, together. And the other one, the children of the apostles, they went out of the captivity, although they had been carried away. And I can't pronounce that.
All right. Are you in verse 5?
Verse 6.
Five, right. Okay, so yeah, that them calling together the nobles as well as the people for the genealogies. Okay.
Are you talking about when they were all there together again, how they began to contribute their means?
Okay, I think that is a significant point. They contribute, and it states it this way. I find it interesting. The difference, verse 70, and I think the differentiation is also made in the New King James, but I know where it's at in the ESV.
5:2 is that, and my God put into my heart together, together.
Mm-hmm.
So God the name.
Right. Okay. In verse 70. He says, now some of the heads of the fathers' houses gave to the work. But then if you go further down, in verse 71, and some of the heads of the fathers' houses gave into the treasury of the work. All right? The implication being, this was actually, my understanding of it is this was in reference to the wall. All right, that work was completed back in the previous chapter. This seems to be in reference to the temple. All right, and he says certain ones made gave contributions to the work, that which was currently going on, and others basically made contributions for that which was going to happen in the future. Okay, so they were making preparations for the future, not just for the immediate. All right, I think it's also interesting. Who was the first one that was listed as making a contribution?
Chief of the
colony. Yes. All right. Actually, the second one listed. Sorry.
The governor.
The governor. Who's that? No. Hananiah were the rulers over the city of Jerusalem. Who was the governor?
Nehemiah.
He doesn't mention himself by name when he talks about the contribution that he made. But the implication is, it's Nehemiah. Nehemiah gives these things to the work. Just so you know, 1,000 derricks of gold, a derrick being a coin weighing about a quarter of an ounce or 8.5 grams, you got 1,000 of those, okay? We're not talking a tiny sum here. 50 basins, 30 priestly garments, 500 manahs of silver, a manah being about a pound and a quarter of silver, and he gives 500 of them, okay? So Nehemiah contributes to the work. And if you go back to the previous chapter, you remember, or actually I think it's chapter 5, Nehemiah already wasn't accepting the governor's pay that he would have been given. He was accepting a certain amount of food out of his own pocket to pay for those who were eating in his house. And on top of that, he gives this money to the work, the implication being of the temple. He was a little well-to-do, all right? And yet, where was his focus?
On him.
Where was his focus?
On getting the wall built.
Getting the wall built, but ultimately, serving God. You might remember Jesus says that it is hard for a rich man to enter into heaven. Mark qualifies that and gives a little bit more explanation. Jesus actually said it's hard for a man who trusts in riches to enter the kingdom of God. Nehemiah was rich. Nehemiah was very rich. He was the cupbearer to the king of all the prophets.
What do you think of prison? Where did he get all the money from?
I think that is an interesting point. And the reason why many of them didn't return from captivity, not because they weren't allowed to. When you understand the kind of captivity they were in, this wasn't hard labor in prison kind of captivity.
No, because they were told to plant vineyards and everything, so I didn't understand.
All right. And so the point is, when they moved to Babylon, or when they were moved to Babylon, Jeremiah and others did, as John pointed out, told them, you go there planning to stay. You plant vineyards. You're not coming home in 2 weeks. All right? The idea being, you make your life there. And that's the reason why many of them didn't come back. Their lives had been in Babylon for 50, 60, 70 years.
A lot of them all their lives.
A lot of them all their lives. They didn't return home, which is part of the reason on the day of Pentecost. You see people from so many different areas, not in Israel, not in Jerusalem, not in Judea, coming to Pentecost. They were still living in far lands because of the captivities that had taken place. They still lived there. They were from there. Okay? So, one other point that I find interesting is that... Where was I at? Verse 65. And the governor said to them that they should not eat of the most holy things till a priest could consult the Urim and the Thummim. The what?
The dice.
Okay.
That God won't.
All right. Does anybody know what the Urim and Thummim are and the significance of the statement?
Well, it was two pieces that the high priest kept in his garment, and it made decisions. They wrote it, and God, whatever it came with, that's what happened.
All right. They were actually on the breastplate of the high priest. Go back to Exodus 28. Somebody's been looking in their center column reference.
Not looking. You want me to be blind?
No.
Thou shalt put on the breastplate of judgment, the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be upon Aaron's heart when he goeth in before the Lord. Aaron shall bear the judgment of the children of Israel upon his heart before the Lord continually.
All right. Go to Leviticus chapter 8, verse 8. All right. This draws out a little bit more of the actual idea of where they were. Then he put on the breastplate on him, and he put the Urim and the Thummim in the breastplate. All right, so they were to an extent attached to the breastplate, but they weren't part of the breastplate. All right, they weren't like sewn into the garment or anything like that. They were separate from it.
Sounds like a pocket.
It seems along that lines. All right. Numbers chapter 27. Numbers 27, verse 21. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, and he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation. All right? So here we have a situation where Eleazar is now the priest, and he says, here's how this is going to work. You're going to base your actions on the judgments of Eliezer through the Urim. All right? One other passage, Deuteronomy 33. Deuteronomy 33, verses 8 and 9. This is Moses making his blessings at the end of his life. All right, he is blessing Israel, each tribe individually, before he dies. Notice what he says, verse 6, let Reuben live and not... verse 6, let Reuben live and not die, nor let his men be few. And he said of Judah, Hear, Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him to his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and may you be a help against his enemies. And of Levi, he said, let your Thummim and your Urim be with your Holy One, whom you tested at Massah, and with whom you contended at the waters of Meribah. What's he praying for?
That God make the decision. I mean, it's not just roll the dice and tie. We've got to pray the two. We've got
it's absolutely. He is praying for Levi and the tribe of Levi to maintain their relationship with God and remain faithful so that God will continue to judge and lead the nation. To make the decisions. To make the judgments within the children of Israel. Now, when you come over to Nehemiah chapter 7, and we read that these people who could not prove their lineage, notice, the governor told them that they were not to partake of the most holy food until a priest with Urim and Thummim should arise. What's he saying?
I'm still saying rolling those dice.
All right.
Maybe that's not a good way to say it.
But the point is, he says, we have no evidence. We have no ability to tell you whether you're qualified to be a priest or not. So once there is someone here qualified, and the indication seems to be there may not have been a high priest at this time. Because he says, until a priest with Urim and Thummim should arise, seems to be there's no high priest in Jerusalem at this moment. All right? But the indication seems to be, he says, or the passage is clear, we don't have the ability to make this decision. So once we have the ability to use the method of judgment, the Old Testament law, Moses' law, prescribed for making this judgment, then you'll know whether or not God accepts you. Okay? Anything else from this chapter?
Makes me wonder why Vegas is called Sin City, God Lake Dice.
In Acts chapter 1, it says when they were choosing Matthias that they cast lots.
Uh-huh.
And that was leaving it up to God rather than to them. So
okay.
Maybe that's where I got to casting the die.
All right. But you do have it. You have a continuation of that thought line there within, even going to the book of Jonah. They cast lots to see who it was that was the problem, who should be thrown overboard to get out of this storm.
You don't see us practicing anything like that, and I don't know that it would be wrong. Would it be wrong if we did not know what a decision was for us to do something and let God decide?
I think most likely that would have been something that would have been a miraculous thing that I don't think we could really count on today. But that's my judgment. I don't think, I'll put it this way, I don't know that we have any scriptural authority or condoning of the continuation of that process.
Other than before the church
right.
began.
Right.
Where are you going to get
the items? Well, it doesn't say they cast a human in the film, it says they cast lots.
Right.
Whatever that means.
Right. Which I don't particularly know what all was involved in that either. One other interesting point, one final one. The very last verse. So the priests and the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, some of the people and the temple servants and all Israel lived in their towns. And when the seventh month had come, the people of Israel were in their towns.
So they all came together to unify.
All right. They came together to be numbered and they went home. Okay. Now, does anybody know what month the building of the wall began?
The little ones behind your screen.
All right, let me ask this, because you'll find the answer in the same passage. Does anybody remember us discussing Nehemiah telling us when the wall was finished? It's the seventh month now. Maybe last week? Try chapter 6. How many days?
90.
Oh. 52. 52 days. And what month was it finished in?
We divided it.
How many days are in a week? Seven times.
Yes, 7 weeks and 3 days. We did the math last week.
Okay. All right. Now, here's something I don't expect you to know unless it just happens to be in the footnotes of your Bible. It was finished in the month Elul. Does anybody know what month that was? I knew somebody would have a Dixon. Dan should have brought his computer like he does on Wednesday nights.
Six months.
Very true. 6 months. What day of the 6 month was the wall completed, according to the verse? 25th day. So, what day did the building begin? What day did the building of the wall begin?
52 days before.
All right. When was it?
Oh, the 30 days or 31 days in that month?
Assuming the month had 30 days. We'll just give you that one. Because I believe the Babylonian calendar, which they were using at the time, because the month was actually Elul. In Babylon, I believe it was set on the 30th.
The month of Ab was when it was started. So the month prior to Elul.
Oh, okay. Was the month that started. Yes. Right. What day? Third day. All right. So, the building of the wall began on the third day of the fifth month. The wall was completed on the 25th day of the sixth month. And by implications, the beginning of the seventh month, everyone had returned to their towns. So you have a wall that is a city wall the size of Jerusalem going up in 52 days, all completed, gates up and everything, and everyone returned home from the work, and it took them less than 2 months. People can do a lot when they get motivated. All right? All of this is important. It's important that we not, first of all, skip over a chapter because it's got a lot of names in it. There's a lot that can be learned from a chapter that's got a lot of names in it. Even though it would help a lot if we could speak Hebrew so we could just pronounce it the way they were originally done and it would be normal for our tongues. But there's things to learn. Did you notice there was specific mention of the sons of Solomon? Don't know of any other particular place where there's a mention of the sons of Solomon. Now, it doesn't seem to be necessarily a specific lineage, maybe more of a position. Maybe those of wise men within the country. Fought. We have priests, sons of Solomon. Sons of Asaph, who were singers. All right. But we learn things if we take time to think. If we just breeze by things like the Urim and the Thummim and we don't know what they are, we don't know what's going on. We have to ask, if I don't recognize these two words, why don't I recognize them, and what was the significance of it, and let me go look, let me go study. That's why it is true that oftentimes it is unfortunate there are many within the church that are ignorant of their Bibles, but not because they don't read. They're ignorant of their Bibles because they don't study. We can read words and not study. If you read, we'll wait until the priest arrives with the Urim and Thummim, well, I can know that. But until I know what it means, it does me no good. But we can lose that as well when our mind becomes numb and starts flowing out of our ears because we've been reading names for 60 verses. Hence the exercise of us thinking, asking, what is this? What is this? Why is this important? It may interest you to note that by the time we finish the book of Nehemiah, the last chapter of the book of Nehemiah is the last recorded bit of history we have of the nation of Israel before the New Testament, biblically speaking. It is the end of Israelite history in the Old Testament, in the Bible. Now you can say, well, it's Malachi's the last book. Yes. We're not talking chronological order when we put the books of the Bible in the order they're in. All right? Nehemiah, the end of it, is the end of the historical history in the Old Testament. And yet we have 400 years of silence until Jesus Christ is brought to the temple, and there a man who had been promised that he would see the Messiah and the return of glory to Israel sees him. 400 years of silence by God, ending with Nehemiah. We should take note of the Old Testament. We should learn. Because even there are times that the small details may not make a great deal of change in our lives, but they make study interesting. It's not the broad brushing that really makes study interesting. It's the details. It's the nuggets of information that make you go, hey, I didn't know that. Which is why people can study the Bible for their whole lives. And at the age of 70 or 80, when they know more than most of us will know in our lifetimes, can say they still love to study God's Word. There's always more to learn. We will not exhaust the knowledge of God in His Word. The point of the lesson has been, don't give up on study. Grow. And be as Hananiah. May it be said of us, he feared God above many. He was faithful. If you're here this evening, and the invitation is applicable to you, you know what's involved therein, why not come? As we stand and as we sing.